STR podcasts are brought to you through the generous support of people just like you. You can support these podcasts by making a gift online at str.org or by phone at 1-800-2-REASON.
Hello, friends. Greg Kokel here on Stand to Reason. And this next hour, I have been looking forward to for a while being involved in a book that deals with an issue that's very important, especially of an interest to me. The issue is theistic evolution. And the author of that book is my guest here today. The book is called Shadow of Oz, and the author is Wayne Rossiter. Wayne, welcome to Stand to Reason.
Hi, Greg. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, it's great to talk with you. I've been reading with interest your book. I read the whole thing. I don't usually read the whole book when I do an interview.
Well, you should get a medal for that right there.
I know. A star next to my name or something. But this, to me, is such an important issue. It's almost, in my view, more important than the issue of evolution itself, as the doctrine of evolution touches the task of the church. Because this theistic evolution is taking this evolutionary doctrine and bringing it into the church under the guise of Christianity. And so it takes on a whole different a form as far as I'm concerned. I see it as a threat. And this is, I guess, the reason that you have written your book, to talk about the coherence of it from a lot of different angles. Your background is actually in a discipline that deals with this. Why don't you tell us about your background?
So I've sort of been in the sciences for 15 years now, undergrad through graduate school, and did a master's in some pretty hardcore molecular evolution and rattlesnake venom proteomics, and then went on from that, oddly enough, to study parasite transmission, disease transmission in ecosystems. And so that degree, so I got a master's in zoology, effectively, and then a PhD in ecology and evolution.
So you are speaking from within the discipline is the main point I'm making. You're not a theologian talking from the outside about evolution. Not that that's inappropriate, but it is a different situation that you find yourself in speaking to this issue.
Well, sure. I mean, as I detail in the book a little, I mean, I was an atheist until 2008.
Right.
So through most of my graduate schooling, I was deeply entrenched in sort of the belly of the beast at major universities and giving talks, and I still give talks, and I still publish papers, and I act as a reviewer for papers, and so I'm still very much, for the time being at least, engaged in the craft of doing science.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's good, because part of the whole assessment has to do with the scientific side. Now, I understand in your book, you're not principally interested in debunking Darwinian evolution. That isn't the purpose of the book. The purpose of the book is something a bit different. Can you spell that out for us?
Right. Well, one caveat to that. Obviously, I do have one chapter dedicated to sort of some of the critiquing Darwinian evolution from within science.
Yeah, but one long chapter. Chapter.
Yeah, that's
six.
The biggest chapter, right?
Yeah.
Well, I didn't want to. That's a chapter that speaks over most people's heads, but for those who are scientists in this field, I want to be able to speak to them about the evidence that's out there.
And I think you do that very well in Chapter 6.
But the major task was more just to lay it out for what it is, not really even take a side, not make you choose, but just say, well, if this is how it is, then this is the sort of God you're left with, if at all. And so I really just wanted to lay out what theistic evolution looks like in their own words. I worked really hard to use their own words rather than to interpret their words and let them speak for themselves, so that the public can sort of just see what this really looks like. It sounds so wonderful superficially, and it just breaks my heart that so many kids in high school and college, they basically get something that goes like, well, Francis Collins believes in evolution, and he's an evangelical Christian, therefore they must be compatible,
right?
Now we're going to move on.
Right.
And I really wanted to unpack that and say, okay, now, so what do you mean by Christianity, given the sorts of other claims you're making? So I really try to just cash that out as best I can and let people decide.
Well, why don't we start here, since we're talking about theistic evolution. Let's just talk about the evolution part descriptively here, because I think understanding what they mean by evolution is really important in terms of assessing its compatibility with classical Christianity, which is what you're comparing it with in your book. So how would you answer the question what evolution is for our audience and for the purpose of your book?
Right. Well, that's the huge sort of clarifying point. And this is actually something I have an audience here to speak to about this. Whenever you hear evolution, you must ask the question, what do you mean by that? Just mm-hmm. as you've taught.
Mm-hmm.
What do they mean by evolution? And what they mean within the context of theistic evolution is it is equivalent to the Darwinian mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there are probably a dozen other vying hypotheses and mechanisms that we could call evolution. And many of those are very compatible with the Christian worldview.
Mm-hmm.
You also must indicate we're talking about a mechanism, not the pattern, because they'll say, well, there's the fact of evolution, when they're just pointing to the pattern.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the mechanism that must explain that pattern. That's the evolution.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're really deeply entrenched in the Darwinian explanation.
By the way, let me just pause for a moment and underscore what you just said. If I understood it correctly, the scientists are pretty consistent in, at least as they represent to the public, their field of evolution, in saying that evolution is a fact. And here they're largely referring to the Darwinian Darwinian system, the mutation, natural selection,
right.
Whatever. And yes, we all agree it's a fact. But when you get down to the particulars and the details, it turns out that there is a tremendous amount of dispute about the details.
Right. Well, So two things there. First of all, yes, I'm not denying the existence of a Darwinian mechanism, and I don't think most sophisticated thinkers are.
Like natural selection, for example.
Obviously.
Yes.
This exists. The question is whether or not it's capable of producing the patterns it needs to explain. The other thing I would say, though, is you take a very classic sort of catchphrase you see on the internet a lot: "We are the fossils, we win."
Mm-hmm.
That is an appeal to the pattern. Hey, there are fossils, therefore evolution.
Mm-hmm.
That is not an explanation as to how you get that fossil record.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just want to make a clear distinction between what we're trying to explain—that is, the data themselves—and the mechanism that we're invoking to explain it. Sort of pull all the way back around. If you're talking about theistic evolution, that is almost entirely reliant on the Darwinian mechanism,
mm-hmm.
which is natural selection acting on random mutations. And by random, it's a lottery, it's a chance event. They often get upset about the use of the word random, but
right.
for our intents and purposes, we mean that it was not intended, it could not be foreknown.
Right, right. Now, this, by the way, is, and I know that in Christian circles, people like William Lane Craig and Alvin Plantinga have kind of stirred up a little controversy on this particular issue, but on the notion of what randomness actually means when spoken by evolutionists. But I'm of the opinion that basically you let the evolutionists speak themselves about what they mean, and when you cite quotation after quotation,
yeah.
of their expression that when they mean the enterprise of Darwinian evolution, they are describing a process that has no intention to it.
Yeah, let me give you just a quick example. Ken Miller, a professor at Brown University, is probably one of the most well-known theistic evolutionists out there.
Right.
And in the high school biology textbook that he co-authored, he said, and I quote, "Of course, there has never been any kind of planned evolution, because evolution works without either plan or purpose. Evolution is random and undirected."
Mm-hmm.
I think that pretty much sums up what the consensus science is.
Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking of the other one. I can't think of the author of it, but the quote is something like that it's a process that did not have us in mind. The particular person, well-known, I don't have it in front of me.
I've
used it before.
You could go to the well again, and Miller actually makes that very clear as well. Says it could have been a big brain dinosaur, or could have ended up being a hyper intelligent mollusk that God sought communion with.
Yeah, well, see, this brings up another point, and this is, and maybe we should get into this later. But part of their commitment to randomness, and I'm talking about not just the evolutionary, the basic evolutionary notion of there's not a mind behind this, but that. Even the theistic evolutionists are going to say, Ken Miller being an example of it, is that it didn't have to be this way.
Right.
We could have been something different.
Yeah, God, perhaps you're God thinking did, of Stephen Gould and his Rewind the Tape.
Rewind the Tape, yeah. But this is what Miller is drawing on, I think, too, when he makes this. So it isn't even on their view, and I want people to catch this, and if I'm making a mistake, you clarify it for me, Dr. Rossiter, if on their view, if you rewound the tape of evolution, to use Gould's phrase, you wouldn't necessarily come up with the same outcomes.
And I think it's actually a bit worse. I think a lot of these folks that are claiming the theistic evolution side don't really go the full Monty that the secular scientists would, which is to say, look, we're invoking a single origin that was an incredibly improbable event. For first life, there's no guarantee that there would have ever been life again on Earth, or that it would survive any of the cataclysmic extinction events that have happened. I mean, there is no guarantee that we ever got past prokaryote bacteria. And so I don't like the idea that they just think, well, yeah, sure, intelligent life is a guarantee. As far as we know, we're the only ones, and people think, you know, the scientists say that's a pretty rare event.
Well, some of them do. Other ones seem to be saying that, you know, if it happened once, it could happen all over the universe. Look at how, against all odds on our planet, it happened in a naturalistic way. Of course, they're presuming this particular point, so it must have...
I don't want to get too far off topic on that, but I will say that earlier this year, in a physics journal dealing with cosmology, a paper came out that said our planet is something like 1 in 700 quintillion. So, I guess you can find different opinions on that, but
So, when we talk about theistic evolutionists, what you've titled your book "Shadow of Oz." Explain to the audience how the title relates to your thesis in the book.
Right. This is where one of those serendipitous things. My daughter, who's about to be five, she just loves The Wizard of Oz, and we've watched it many, many, many times. And I was sitting there watching it while I was sort of mulling over a lot of these thoughts. I never actually intended to write a book. I just wanted to have this stuff down for myself for discussion. Because I run into it a lot in my field. And it just occurred to me when the entourage, shows up at the gates and rings the knocks on the door and he sticks his head out and he says, you know, you want to see, you know, the Great Oz? Nobody's seen Oz. Not even I've seen Oz. And Dorothy just says, well, how do you know he exists? And this sort of, I think, is when it clicked for me, that's effectively what we've got here is a very, very blatant, open, and explicit desire to not ever have God poking his fingers into the natural world. And then somehow behind that, I mean, this is how I've said it, and I actually think this is a fair characterization. If you're a theistic evolutionist, the best evidence that God is active in everything is the fact that you cannot detect him in anything.
Say that again, because I think it's really important.
Well, I mean, so what I said was the best evidence that God is active in everything is the fact that we can't detect him in anything. And that is that there's just a blatant appeal to naturalism through and through. You know, for people who pick up my book, I think I show this fairly powerfully. I take four well-known atheists, scientists, creation stories, their explanation of the unfolding of the entire cosmos up until today. And I put it against Carl Giberson, one of the co-founders at BioLogos. I promise you can't tell the difference.
Yeah, BioLogos is a prominent theistic evolutionist
organization. They're one of the big camps.
And you had me stumped, by the way, when I read those five pieces. I could not find... as I read, and that was the quiz, read these five quotes and tell me which one came from the Christian. And I couldn't tell the difference. And I think what this underscores, and this is a very important point you make in your book, and maybe you can elucidate this, when it comes to the facts of historical science regarding the biological development of the world, the theistic evolutionists are no different in their understanding of what the facts are than the atheistic evolutionists. Is that a fair thing to say?
Yeah, I mean, with one exception, which I'll get to in a moment.
Okay.
But in general, I mean, yes, they're lockstep with a completely naturalistic unfolding of the cosmos,
mm-hmm.
To the point which some of them are sort of equivocal on even sort of whether or not God created the universe. Well, maybe it was a multiverse, and that's
mm-hmm.
fine because they'll just pop God even farther back there somewhere. And,
mm-hmm.
and so they basically, what they have, the only difference is not the evidence in hand, it's the interpretation of the evidence, and what they rely on is an assumption. They assume God, and I had mentioned this actually to Ted Davis recently. I said, you know, one of my concerns with what theistic evolution is doing is that it's casting a very narrow net. Essentially, if I interpret what they're doing correctly, they're basically catching Christians as they fall towards atheism because of Darwinian evolution. And they're saying, no, stop short, you know,
mm-hmm.
and we can offer you some compatibilist view on this.
Mm-hmm.
They're not interested in convincing anybody else that God exists. That you start with the assumption that God
yeah.
exists, and then you say, now, no matter what we find, God did it.
Yeah, this is one thing that I've thought a lot about that came out in the book, is that they are not evangelists for theism. These theists are evangelists for evolution.
Yep.
That is, they are aiming their efforts at Christians to persuade Christians to believe in evolution and therefore not sacrifice their faith on the altar of evolution, instead of trying to aim their efforts at atheists and trying to persuade them to become theists of some sort.
Right. I mean, it's dramatic that, you know, for example, one of the titles in one of their books is Finding Darwin's God. It's not Finding
right.
God's Darwin.
Right.
And this is not... And nobody's fooled. Nobody's missing this. I mean, just, I think, last month, Slate magazine had an article about it, and in it they basically just identify theistic evolution. They call it training wheels towards atheism.
Mm-hmm.
You'll realize at some point that you don't need God to explain any of this stuff, so why mm-hmm. bother? It becomes mm-hmm. like the leprechaun example you talk about.
That's right. Yeah,
you can boil water without a leprechaun, so why bother?
That's right.
And I find that with the God. I mean, why on earth would anybody... And I think it has huge theological implications, and we'll have maybe time to get into that. But, you know, when you get somebody like John Haught saying that we look in vain for God in the history of nature or human history, if mm-hmm. we're looking for special divine intervention, that applies to today.
Mm-hmm.
That means that God was not doing anything, and he is not doing anything.
Uh-huh. Now, I sometimes wonder if they were to take on an atheist, if they were to do some evangelism, real evangelism, for the gospel's sake, what would they say to the atheists? What would they offer? They certainly wouldn't offer any design arguments from biology.
Right.
What they might do, and you testified to this, and this is also a curious inconsistency, is they might identify design arguments from the fine-tuning of the universe, and some too hold to that.
Yes. Yeah, you get a sort of an appeal to that, some more strongly than others. But there does seem to be a sort of, and the problem with that is that it ultimately really, it's not really even a fine-tuning argument. I think what they typically would fall back on is a first cause, sort of Thomistic, mm-hmm. Thomas Aquinas view.
But doesn't it
fully... Which is philosophical, not
right,
scientific.
Right, but what doesn't this idea of a fully gifted creation, and you know, mm-hmm. I'm looking at break time here. When I come back, I want to talk a little bit about the notion of fully gifted creation, because I think this helps to explain the mindset, what they think in part is defensible about their, theologically now, about their view of theistic evolution, apart from the science, which they're quite convinced of, but their theological notions. Talking with Wayne Rossiter, he is the author of Shadow of Oz, which is a superb book in addressing the issue of theistic evolution. I'm Greg Kokel. You're listening to Stand to Reason. Stay with us.
Do you want to become a more equipped Christian ambassador? One of the best ways to do so is waiting for you now at str.org, and it's free. Just visit the homepage at str.org and click on Subscriptions at the top. From there, you can choose to receive newsletters, updates, and training resources delivered to your inbox for free. You can choose from Greg's Mentoring Letter, Ambassador Insights, Tactics, Solid Ground, STRE News from Greg, as well as monthly newsletters from Brett and Alan, and more. They are all loaded with practical, concise, useful tools to help you be a better ambassador for Christ. And they're all free and easy to share with friends. So elevate your expertise as a Christian ambassador right now. Visit str.org, click on subscriptions, and take advantage of what's waiting for you there.
Have you been on a college campus lately? The intellectual and moral challenges awaiting our youth are immense. Are the students in your home, your church, or your youth group prepared for what lies ahead? Sadly, most Christian students are ill-prepared for an aggressive secular campus and culture. It's time to step up the training of our young people, and Stand to Reason will help you do just that. Join us this fall for our two-day Rethink Student Apologetics Conference. In September, we'll be in Orange County, California. In October, we'll be in Dallas, Texas, and we'll equip your students with a reason for the hope they have in Jesus. Go to RethinkApologetics.com and register today.
Hi, I'm Alan Schliemann. Are Christians to blame for the Orlando shooting? Find out in this month's episode of my podcast, Thinking Out Loud. Look for it on iTunes or the bottom of the homepage at str.org.
Cause he likes it better busted, and I'm afraid they're walking through the dark.
There's our friends again, Good Little Giants. Greg Kokel here with Stand to Reason, and Wayne Rossiter and his book, Shadow of Oz. Dr. Rossiter got his PhD in Ecology and Evolution from Rutgers University, and is the author of this book and another one, Mind Over Matter, The Necessity of Metaphysics in a Material World. Wayne, when we took a break, I was just beginning to raise the question or the issue of fully gifted creation. So far, we understand that theistic evolutionists like the crowd at BioLogos, Francis Collins, famously Ken Miller, also from Brown University, well-known names in kind of this movement, are thoroughly convinced of the Darwinian model as classically conceived. Is that a fair thing to say as a generalization?
Oh yeah, yeah. The Darwinian mechanism is not up for grabs.
Yeah. Okay. So this is the fixed point in this in the discussion. So with regards to the biological development of life on Earth, they are four square with the materialists on this point, and they are not going to budge on that.
Yep.
Okay. So, I mean, that by itself.
Well, you know, again, and I just want to back that up with a second consideration. I mean, I point this out in the book as well. Don't be misled by the idea that this is about evolution. This is a full-blown creation account. Mm-hmm. from the Big Bang to the present, from cosmological evolution, planetary evolution, geological evolution, biological, even sociological. Mm-hmm. I mean, recently Francis Collins suggested that perhaps morality is evolved. Carl Giberson believes that evolution made us selfish by invoking selfish gene theory, that we were literally evolved evil. So the very mechanism God would have used to make us made us evil. Mm-hmm. Think about theologically what that must mean.
Yeah, yeah, and there are more theological problems with this. We'll get to that in just a moment, but I'm glad you mentioned it. But their fixed point is the Darwinian project. They're not budging on that. Okay, well, then they've got this desire to marry that to a theology, and that's because, for whatever reasons, they are also committed to some form of Christian theology. Is that fair?
Yep.
Okay, and so wanting to have their cake and eat it too, so to speak, they're trying to find a marriage. Now, one way they seek to accomplish this is to talk about the notion of a fully gifted creation. I think Howard Ventil came up with the term. But can you tell us what they mean by that and what work they hope that approach will do?
Well, I would actually sort of pause here. I don't want to be accused of lumping everybody together.
Sure.
There are at least three different ways of getting that within theistic evolution. Mm-hmm. Ken Miller and Francisco Ayala and good many others we could just name drop, from what I can tell, they're open theists. They don't think that God knows what's going to happen next. Mm-hmm. And it's just open for the creation to, quote, create itself. I mean, mm-hmm. that's what John Polkinghorne says.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got a sort of open theism where the outcomes aren't pre-designed. There's nothing, you know, it's just unfolding, and it's a surprise to God as well.
Yeah, but it's even worse than that, because there's some implication by the things they say that creation is choosing, and God has given creation choice, a freedom of choice to be what it wants to be. I mean, that's
Stardust
kind of works
doesn't have any free will.
Yeah.
So, but
that's the language they use.
Right. And people picked up on that. I mean, the guys over at Discovery have been harping on that for a while. There's mm-hmm. this really strange sort of mystic pantheism in there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's one view. Mm-hmm. Another one is actually one in which you have basically a grand puppet master in control of everything. This would be something like what Stephen Barr offers, or Dennis Lumereux. And, you know, Lumereux, for example, he basically says, imagine God as a billiards player, and he's so good that when he strikes the ball on the first strike, all the balls sink in order.
Mm-hmm.
He's got this sort of Rube Goldberg machine that just unfolds in perfect dominoes falling effect to achieve everything he intended.
Right.
That's another view.
But that would be like a hyper-deterministic approach.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
And that has its own problems, because what about evil and all the other things and free will and et cetera?
Yeah, the third one is sort of somewhere in between those two,
mm-hmm.
Where there's some flexibility and some free will invoked into the system, but at the same time, not sort of going open theism.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and I think that's probably more like what you're probably getting with a BioLogos crowd. So you've got a God who starts it off and then walks away, and he doesn't know what's going to happen. You've got a God who starts it all and knows exactly what's going to happen.
Pulls every string.
Or you've got a God who's sort of engaged actively, and you get a lot of reference to God the Sustainer mm-hmm. in that literature, but not in any detectable way. So God mm-hmm. is present at all times, but he's not. If he's acting, it's not really something you can detect. And that's one thing I would just say. You know, they say, well, God's not a scientific hypothesis, and what they mean is that God can't be detected scientifically. I find that just flatly false. The way in which God acts, any being outside of the universe or in the supernatural, immaterial, such being, sure, you're not going to be able to explain a mechanism for action, but you can still detect the action.
Right.
And I think that's a huge difference.
That's a good distinction. I like
that. And this would actually be, I mean, so they all claim Jesus, which I find just, you know, strange.
Mm-hmm.
So they deny, most of them deny the existence of angelic beings, demons, what have you, Satan. That God's not active as God the Father, but Jesus is all that the Bible claims him to be in theistic evolution.
Well, isn't part of what the concept of fully gifted creation entail is the idea, and I think some deists have argued this way in the past, is God sets it up just right, and then it's like he lays out his dominoes in a very, very sophisticated pattern, and then he knocks over the first domino, but it sets everything that he laid out just so in place. Now, if he's got to go in there somewhere down the line with the dominoes and do a reset on something, it's because he didn't do his job right in the first place. But fully gifted means he can just get it started, breathe life into it, do the Big Bang, and then have it all flow out just the way he wants it to be. And what they mean by that is not just cosmic evolution, planetary evolution, all of that stuff, Big Bang stuff, but they also mean biological evolution will fall in just the same way. Is that a fair characterization of the fully gifted approach?
Yeah, I think with fully gifted, it's sort of just as it suggests. God has given the universe all it needs to arrive at intelligent life.
On its own, though, without any further intervention.
So. Yeah.
So I actually don't see how this is very much different from the second kind of God pulling all the strings, because God he's not making every mutation himself, and maybe that's what the Barr version is, that he causes each mutation, but he sets up the preconditions that will necessarily result in these mutations.
Right.
And so it turns out to be the same kind of it seems to me.
Yeah, the distinction would be something like setting up a lottery bin where you have, you know, you've got all the balls flopping around in there, and then mm-hmm. you're going to pick one out. The difference would be, in one form of theistic evolution, God knows exactly the number that's going to pop up.
Mm-hmm.
So everything's determined. In the other form, you could have it so that he's only interested in knowing that some ball, some lottery winner will pop up.
Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't necessarily know which number. He just knows that some number will be chosen. And that's sort of the subtle distinction.
And then he's going to use whatever comes up. But this is why the end result could have been Homo sapiens. It could have been a dinosaur with a large brain.
Yeah, yeah.
That God has a personal relationship with.
I mean, I sort of joke about this, but with Miller saying that it could have been a hyper-intelligent mollusk, I sort of say, well, you know, if you like your Messiah molluskin, then he's your man. But and I have this wonderful picture of the Mother Mary as a mollusk holding a little mm-hmm. mollusk. But, mm-hmm. For talks. But yeah, I mean, I do that almost to mock it so that people understand how absurd this gets very quickly.
Yeah, yeah.
It's very, very strange.
Well, I think there's a point that can be made if you just look at the at cosmological development, because it strikes me that, you know, I'm not an astrophysicist, but I think that the physics of it is fairly simple. Once everything is tuned just so, which is one of the arguments for God, then God can kick off that first domino, and then the universe is going to develop mechanistically in just the right way to make life possible here on this little blue dot that we have called Earth. I don't have any problem with that at all. And I think that's where the design argument comes in with regards to the fine-tuned constants of the universe. That makes sense to me. But I don't see how you can get from that to the first life.
Right.
And then after you get life, once you get some kind of even primitive decision-making capability, now you don't have just event causations. Now you don't have just the dominoes falling that brings the universe along. Now you've got agents of some sort that are making their own decisions to go wherever they want. And so how does one guarantee a certain result when you have all kinds of agents doing their own thing? That's
right.
Where I think one place where the fully gifted notion just falls apart.
Right. Well, I suggest, at least in the book, that this is something like the butterfly effect, right? So
right.
Once you introduce an agent that can act against basic physical laws, then you don't know what's going to happen, and
that's
that
right.
will create rippling effects going forward in history, and those things amplify. Actually, within engineering theory, there's a lot about this. Is why the Rube Goldberg universe, where you just set everything up perfectly and let it go, can't work. Is that you start to accumulate small rounding errors, unless you assume infinity in every direction at all times.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It is impossible to predict even just a short number of steps forward, especially if you introduce an agent. You know, forget rounding errors. If you're
right.
if you're putting an agent in there, then the universe no longer knows what's happening next. Physics isn't determining that.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
well, of course, you're talking when you just talk about it's impossible to predict. Rounding errors come from people trying to know what's going to happen, but God can set it up so it does happen a certain way. I mean, if you look at it from that side, kind of the ontological or metaphysical side as opposed to the epistemological side, maybe we can't figure it out, but God can know how it's going to unfold.
Right. So again, that becomes a theological assumption, a metaphysical assumption.
Mm-hmm.
Not something that is evident from science,
mm-hmm.
and they're reliant on science.
Now, these guys think that the theistic evolution crowd thinks that they are rescuing Christianity.
Well, I mean, yeah.
It seems to me this is their thing. They're trying to save Christians from atheism, trying to show that atheism is not the necessary result of the fact of Darwinian. Mechanisms.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose they believe they're doing a good service in convincing everybody to just buy in, to stop sort of even questioning these sorts of things.
Mm-hmm.
And what I would say to that is, you know, if that's their view, they haven't really stayed up to speed with what's happening in science.
Mm-hmm.
That's the real irony, is they think they're sort of saying, stop having a war with science. Just accept that science is compatible with our Christianity, and it's the Christianity that's going to be molded around what science tells us. Even if we do that, fine, but they're still wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Because I believe they're wrong about a lot of the science.
About the science, right.
And you know, not just the Darwinian thing, but certainly the Darwinian thing. As one example, you can go right now, anybody listening can go and type in thethirdwayofevolution.org and go see people like Eugene Koonin at NCBI. James Shapiro, University of Chicago, elite biologists who flatly deny the power of the Darwinian mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not rare. They're not fringe. Mm-hmm. The literature is robust with questioning about it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they might put on a sort of, you know, hoplite phalanx of protection. They might circle the wagons in public. But within the literature and within the dialogue that happens behind closed doors and at meetings, there is serious questioning about whether or not the Darwinian mechanism is sufficient. And there are people, you know, again, I don't want to sit here and name drop because most people won't know who these guys mm-hmm. are, but Stuart Coffin just flatly denies it. Paul Davies flatly denies the power mm-hmm. of the mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
And they're looking for other things, and some of those things are really wacky. I mean, you've got Nobel laureates suggesting that life was seeded here by aliens.
Right.
That's not a rare view.
Right.
That's not fringe either.
It's actually been around for quite a while now.
Since 73 at least. And it was proposed, for a long time before that, but it found its way into scientific literature at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And it has actually gained traction mm-hmm. in recent years.
But the reason, just so the point is not lost, the reason is because of the difficulty of an unguided process to produce even the simplest form of life.
And the mechanism, it just hasn't been demonstrated.
Right.
There are lots of other things trying to either augment or flatly replace a broken mechanism.
Mm-hmm. So here's the question that I have. I want next segment, our final segment, I want to get into some of the problems with science. The attempt here is to marry the fact of evolution with classical Christianity, and most of your argument is that this destroys classical Christianity if you accept the kind of evolution that they accept. But then you also argue that this is kind of like hitching your boat to the Titanic because this is on the way out. These guys are kind of behind the times, ironically. My question in a piece I wrote a couple of years ago that I think you did reference in your book was, if you want to say that God used evolution, it sounds really great. Okay, you got your evolution, you saved God, it all sounds great. But the devil's in the details. What exactly did God do? That's my question. So how would a theistic evolutionist answer, or maybe some would give different kinds of answers, but they've got to answer that question, it seems to me, if we're going to take seriously the claim that God used Darwinian evolution. So what did God do?
Well, yeah, I think the problem is that it's a pretty mixed bag. And all of them would agree that God used evolution, but the question is how actively was he participating? What did he know? How much of it was cashed out? What I've seen recently, and I've actually been blogging about this, I sort of basically have continued to update my book continuously with new stuff that comes out,
mm-hmm.
is this appeal to a very old argument from Aubrey Moore, a contemporary of Darwin himself, who basically said Darwin threw down the gauntlet and we were left with a decision between either a God who was not there or a God who was everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's really what they'll say. And I've pushed people on this, that the rise in Thomistic thinking has pushed this pretty hard. I've pushed to get an answer. What does that look like? And mm-hmm. and it's this really, really flowery but sort of vapid immanence of God stuff. I mean, it sounds great, but they never get down to the brass tacks of exactly what they mean by that. God is sustaining things. I've been told that God is a table upon which the dominoes fall.
And what does that mean? That's a nice illustration, but it doesn't. I'm not sure what it illustrates, you know.
And
we wouldn't disagree with the idea of God sustaining things. That's classical Christian theology.
Of course. But what they're stuck with, and you mentioned this earlier, is this idea that if God pokes his fingers in, that he somehow was a failure at the first creation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I don't think any fair reading of the Bible, cover to cover, suggests that. I think what you've got is a sustaining God
who's involved,
who has immanence, but is also actively participating in this with us.
Yeah, that's a core part of our message.
And it's not just Jesus, They can't make sense of the fall. And it comes down to this thing, you haven't even brought up the phrase yet, but what they're really scared of is this God of the Gaps fallacy. Mm-hmm.
Well, look, we got to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about the response to the God of the Gaps. We're going to talk about the fall, and we're going to talk a little bit about the current status of the Darwinian, the neo-Darwinian synthesis. So Greg Kokel here talking with Wayne Rossiter, the book Shadow of Oz. Back in a moment.
Carry STR with you by downloading our Stand to Reason and Quick Reference apps for free. Both are available for iPhone, iPad, and Android. From your STR app, listen to the weekly podcast, speaker podcasts, check out the STR blog, Access Solid Ground, Greg's mentoring letters, and more. The Quick Reference app gives you the tools you need to answer the toughest questions Christians face, all through the easy-to-read text and short videos. You'll have STR resources at your fingertips in a clean layout with great features and functionality. And they're free. So download the apps today and start carrying STR with you everywhere you go.
There's always something new for you on the STR.org homepage, where you'll find sound analysis and careful commentary on the issues challenging Christians today. Along with new articles each month from Greg, Brett, and Alan, you'll also find new blog posts every day, new podcasts and featured articles each week, a new featured resource each month, and updated news about local and online events. So take a few moments to browse the STR.org homepage and see what's new today. And keep coming back to stay informed and encouraged as you grow as a Christian ambassador. Stop by today and every day at STR.org.
Greg Kokel back at you here. Stand to Reason. Giving you a piece of my mind along with Wayne Rossiter. He's assistant professor of biology at Waynesburg University. Took a PhD in ecology and evolution from Rutgers. And we're talking about his book that deals with theistic evolution. So three things here in 10 minutes that are biggies, okay? The constant refrain, accusation, of God of the Gaps when any attempt is made to infer from the facts an intelligent designer.
Right. And I have again, dialogued with theistic evolutionists about this, and I just, for the life of me, cannot figure out this seeming inconsistency, because they reject almost everything else that would be a supernatural claim within the Bible, mm-hmm. Front to back, except for Jesus, mm-hmm. And yet they'll keep that. So the God of the Gaps basically says something like, when we have a gap in our knowledge, scientific knowledge, we will just fill it with God did it. Mm-hmm. And then what they fear is that the history of that sort of tactic hasn't worked out well, that repeatedly science has filled that gap, and so God's job description keeps shrinking.
Mm-hmm.
I find that, again, just to sort of be completely at odds with what contemporary science is really doing, and this is why they hate the ID community, and I don't hate, like, personally, but they hate the ideas
right.
being espoused by the ID community, that somehow science can make a positive case for agency, mm-hmm. for intelligent action, which mm-hmm. lends itself to belief in God.
Well, you've got disciplines in science that are meant to do that, like archaeology and forensic pathology and all kinds of stuff like that.
Right. Well, yeah, and I mean, again, that sort of gets in the weeds a little bit. Well, you don't have to go even into human stuff. I mean, so I do ecology. There's an entire enterprise within ecology. It's called theory of mind, in which when we go out and look at a mess and some bramble out in the field, it doesn't take an ecologist very long to identify that that's a nest of a ground nesting bowerbird.
Uh-huh.
It was intelligently made. It's not going to randomly show up.
Right.
Something meant to do that.
Right.
So we invoke intelligence every day of the week in science.
Mm-hmm.
The big catch becomes when you start saying that intelligence somehow is outside of naturalistic causes itself.
Right.
And that's a whole other discussion. But that sort of becomes the problem. And yet the theistic evolutionists will throw down Jesus and all the miracles and his miraculous existence and resurrection. And
with no trouble, that doesn't bother them.
Because they realize that they have to make that claim.
If they're going to keep the theistic part.
So you can drop everything else, including angelic beings, which are heavily referenced by Jesus,
yeah,
right?
Right.
You can drop all that. But you have to have a resurrected Jesus for there to be Christianity.
Well, they sometimes also make an appeal to the fine-tuned constants of the universe as evidence for God, right? I mean, you did mention that was true for some of them.
Sure.
And
sure.
So there's a double standard again.
Yeah, and I don't want to pin him because I haven't talked to him much about this. But in April, I got a chance to interact with Robin Collins, who is probably best known in the world for the fine-tuning arguments, maybe even beyond William Lane Craig.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm pretty sure he goes for theistic evolution.
Hmm.
But he is a strong proponent of the fine-tuning arguments.
Yeah,
easy because it's outside of the universe, so God of the Gaps doesn't apply because you can't disprove that.
Well, a lot of the atheists have attempted to kind of implicitly make that claim by saying you don't have to go to God, we can go to multiverse or something like that. So they're making attempts to keep God out even on that level. But
that would be a good example of science at least lending some sort of evidence to the case for an agent.
Right, absolutely.
So I don't understand the God of the Gaps. The other thing is you can't win, because what it means is that no matter what we don't know, you can never invoke a supernatural cause.
Right.
On the off chance that in the future we might have a scientific explanation. To me, that seems like science of the gaps.
Well, yeah, it's not only science of the gaps, but it's always struck me as circular. And the reason is that that when ID guys invoke God, they don't invoke God in virtue of the absence of information, but the presence of information.
Yep.
Or I should say evidence, which the evidence is information, for example. And so it is in light of the things we actually do know, not what we don't know, that causes us to invoke an intelligent agent. And so the circularity here is that in many cases, there is no gap. That is, there is no explanatory gap.
There's not missing science. There's science in favor of hypothesis.
Well, what I was saying is they want to say there's a gap because science, naturalistic science, can't provide an explanation. But it isn't that there's a gap where there's no good explanation for the evidence. The evidence can be explained by a supernatural agent, but they won't allow it. But
right.
They won't allow it because of their prior commitment to naturalism, and this is why it's circular, because they're saying there's a hole there because there's no naturalistic answer,
right.
Which means there is a naturalistic answer that we haven't come to yet. That's all we're waiting on. And that's the circularity that was getting it.
And in logic form, it also sets up, forces, you know, the ID proponent to prove a universal negative.
Mm-hmm.
They can roll through the Rolodex to infinity, and as long as they can come up with some other hypothesis that might be naturalistic, we're not allowed to invoke agency.
Right.
And this is what Steve Meyer has worked really hard on, is appealing to the best explanation. I think it's entirely possible that you simply come to the realization that there is no naturalistic mechanism capable of producing certain patterns.
Yeah. Let's talk about Adam and Eve for a moment, because
sure.
This is the big theological bogeyman, I think, that's on the table right now. And I was at an event 2 years ago, and I heard Dennis Lamoureux actually put up a slide, and the slide was in big, giant, bold letters, "There was no Adam."
Yeah.
And Dennis holds to classical Christian theology.
Evangelical. Yeah.
Evangelical. And he still denies the existence of Adam, of an historical Adam. And when I asked, I got one question from the crowd, and I got my hand up first, and I asked him, what about a fall from original innocence? And he said, it's irrelevant, is what his response. It's just irrelevant to anything. And so here you've got a central feature of classical Christian doctrine, that's the fall, that necessitates the rescue, and, you know, the incarnation and all kinds of other things that seem to be tied to it, and these are flatly denied by people like Dennis Lamoureux and his crowd.
So with the time we have, I'll give the really broad sort of characterization of the problem.
Okay.
And I talk about this in my book. The story of the Bible, of Christianity, is that the creation begins good, it is compromised by sin, it is put into a state of decay that it must be rescued from. So you move from good to decay through time. Things like fully gifted theology, and basically, I'm not aware of any of the theistic evolution views that don't have this, you start from chaos and work towards perfection.
Mm-hmm.
And so you don't have a fall, and if you don't have a fall, then there's no reason to have a salvation from that thing.
Mm-hmm.
There was never a sin to rescue us from, in that sense. And so I've always found it's almost like the theology is perfectly on its head.
Mm-hmm.
And
what sense do you make of the second coming then, of a restoration and new heavens and new earth, if we're really in the process of being perfected?
Well, the assumption is that certainly we're not the end point, are we?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, another thing that you see oftentimes, Lemieux is actually a good example because I don't know why he pulls this up, but he pulls up polygenism, a term of slow movement from race to race, actually a term that was used in the eugenics movement, which I find sort of abhorrent.
Mm-hmm.
But he uses this to discuss moral culpability. I mean, was there some ape-like thing, some primate that had quasi-moral culpability that sort of was responsible for its actions but wasn't quite human yet? It's very hard without invoking God to do something,
mm-hmm.
To say at what point we suddenly became aware of sin from eating the apple in the story.
Yeah, I've talked with Stephen Meyer on this point, and he said that the theistic evolutionists, which, by the way, he said he's having more trouble with now than the evolutionists, Stephen Meyer over at the ID Discovery Institute,
yep.
He says their view is we didn't fall down to sin, we fell up
yep.
into consciousness.
Yep. Yeah, that's a very, very standard phrase you'll see a lot, the fall up. So it's not a fall in which we become distanced from God because of sin.
Mm-hmm.
It's a fall up towards him when we become aware of sin and the way he's aware of it.
So I'm really curious what this does to their soteriology, their doctrine of salvation, because if that's the case, I guess they must acknowledge some kind of sin. I mean, this is hard not to acknowledge. Even non-believers acknowledge this. Something's wrong with man.
Yeah, but I think you get a mix. I think that you have a good number of folks, even those who have changed since this sort of became popular in the last 10 or 15 years, I think you've seen people slide towards a situation in which they actually will invoke a Darwinian explanation for social code.
Mm-hmm.
And so even there, you've got a sort of naturalistic rather than spiritual level of sin
mm-hmm.
invoked. And the other one, I mean, I can't speak for all of them, but from my reading of John Haught as an example, Georgetown University theologian, he doesn't think there is salvation for us beyond death.
Hmm.
And so what happens, as he puts it, is that we are remembered by God, that he experiences us, and then we are remembered in him. I think that's actually probably where a lot of folks are going to go.
Well, if there's such damaging results of theistic evolution to classical theology, how is it you got people like I'm thinking of Tremper Longman over at Westmont, and who, as I understand, kind of joined the crowd, and a whole bunch of other theologians that seem to be falling left and right in favor of theistic evolution when it has so much danger for classical theology?
Well, that may be a question beyond my wife has actually asked me why.
Mm-hmm.
Why are they going? And I actually can't tell you what is persuading them so much. I can only assume that they just haven't put it all together.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you see it for what it is, then you see the world from Darwin's eyes. And Darwin shifted away from. I mean, he admits that he became agnostic.
Mm-hmm.
He had contempt for Christianity in the end.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the great peril. You know, the task of theistic evolution is to convince people to believe in God when Darwin couldn't do it.
Yeah, well, that is a very interesting way of putting it. Last thing, we got 2 minutes here, so say something about we're going to shift completely secular right now, and I want you to say something about the contemporary status of the neo-Darwinian synthesis. This is kind of in a field, an upheaval, when you look behind the inner circle, so to speak, when you look behind the unified front that they present against the creationists and ID crowd. Inside, there's a lot of turmoil. You mentioned a website and a group. Say a little bit more about that.
Well, yeah, and so again, just so I enjoy referencing the literature itself. So Eva Jablanka, writing in the Journal of Genetics and Molecular Biology, a review, she says, and I quote, "Many biologists feel the foundations of the evolutionary paradigm that was constructed in the 30s and 40s and has dominated Western views of evolution for 60 years are crumbling, and that the construction of a new evolutionary paradigm is underway."
Mm-hmm.
And that was in 2008.
Mm-hmm.
In my book, I cover a whole bunch of people who are looking for alternatives front-loaded stuff. There's something special about the problem-solving algorithm of, mm-hmm. of life when it was first formed. It can navigate the space of options, not in a chance or random walk, but it knows where it's going.
But there's a sense in which Darwin is beginning to crumble, even though there remains a commitment to some form of evolution. The Darwinian model is not the thing that runs
yeah.
it.
Well, you get reference to emergent theory. So rather than bottom up, it's top down. So mm-hmm. the complete annihilation of the reductionist view that Darwin had mm-hmm. in favor of something like what Melanie Mitchell would talk about with complexity.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually think this is very. I mean, what I want to say is this is actually very heartening for the Christian because
yeah.
what they're moving towards feels more and more like they need an agent.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them openly say so, as long as that agent's an alien.
Sure. Well, so. When you have Thomas Nagel writing his short book that deals with what he sees as the shortcomings of naturalism, really created Mind and Cosmos created mm-hmm. quite a stir.
Yeah.
But he says, I'm not willing to go that direction with God. He's just trying to expand the definition of naturalism to include more of what's real about the world, including consciousness. So
right.
there's a lot of upheaval here, and I think it's safe to say that Darwinism is not considered a fact anymore. There's not unanimity about Darwinism being a fact within the scientific community.
Right. Well, at the very minimum, it's not the only game in town.
Yeah.
It has been recognized. I think what we can say safely is that it has been recognized within the scientific community that it needs to be augmented or supplemented at a minimum.
Yeah.
And perhaps replaced, but it certainly needs to be supplemented. This would be. You know, Massimo Pigliucci, I have a lot of respect for him, actually, and he's worked really hard in philosophy to try to catch up to speed with the dialogue in theism. And,
mm-hmm.
and he has offered what he considers the extended synthesis. So there's the new synthesis, and now there's the extended one, which incorporates all these other things beyond Darwin.
Well, your chapter six, is probably the most complex chapter and will be satisfying for people, especially who traffic in biological circles and really understand the field. But I got a lot out of it myself. But it makes a very, very strong point that all elements of the neo-Darwinian synthesis, whether it's mutation or natural selection, the two basic pieces, are really under challenge as to their merits.
Based on science. Yeah.
Yeah, based on science as to what they can actually accomplish. And it was a great read, Wayne, and I thank you for spending so much time to put this together. It must have been a real labor of love, I guess.
This will shock you. I wrote it in 8 days, the first draft.
No kidding.
I had been working on thinking it through in my own mind for about 3 years.
Oh.
And in winter, a few years back, I sat down during a break between semesters, and it poured out in 8 days.
Well, you're either a fast typist or you dictated a lot of it, but...
I don't expect. I've written another book, and I'm working on a third, and those are much, much slower, I can promise. But it was really one of those things where I just think the timing was right, and it just all sort of clicked at the same moment, just poured out.
It did click. Shadow of Oz is the book. Wayne Rossiter is the author. Thanks, Wayne, for spending some time with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
All the best. That's it for our show, friends. I'm Greg Kokel. Give them heaven this week. Bye-bye now.
Listening to Stand to Reason. Listen to a new one-hour podcast every Wednesday and Friday. Our podcasts are made possible by friends of this ministry through their generous support. You can support STR by giving a gift online at str.org.